Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. As I said, the poem that I always remember for this purpose was It Was the Ancient Mariner, He Stoppeth One of Three. By his long grey beard and glittering eye, wherefore thou stoppeth me. How I remember that was because when I was at school, that's what I used to use for the 100 line when I got it when I was a naughty boy. And it served its purposes there. Although I will say this, touch wood, I never had to use it. But that was the emergency code. Anyway, we as it progressed, as I said, we were above a place, Quisca, above Cormon. Every day we got new recruits to the unit. There were all kinds of people coming up the hill to join us. There were peasants, labourers, professors, doctors, all kinds of people came up to join us. Some have been chased out of their houses and one thing and another. But what we were always afraid of were, had people been sent up on a special course to infiltrate the group? That was left to the Italians. We didn't speak Italian. Hedley Vincent, I think he can make himself understood, but, you know, he didn't speak fluent Italian. This was left to the Italian.
Did you see them deal with any suspects?
Oh, yes. They dealt with people like that, and also any fascists that they caught. And we were told to keep clear of this, but you did see it. You couldn't keep clear, we were in a close community. And they held what was like a kangaroo court. It was, you know, it was a little bit disgusting. And if a fellow was found guilty, he was said the verdict was, I always remember it, Miss Portaferina, carry the flower. You've got to carry the flower. And that meant they were taken outside and they were shot there and then. Just like that.
Why were the kangaroo caught so disgusting?
Well, to me, you know, I haven't seen what these people have done. But there are, you know, every fascisti was a fascisti, you know, and that. And we were told to keep clear of it. But as I said, we're being so close to it, you couldn't help but see it. Amongst the partisans, there were girls there who did a most marvellous job, and I think the Italian women, you know, have been more or less had always been of a servile nature, and same with the Yugoslavs. And I think this is why the women, those particular in those days, played took a man's role and did it very well. They just showed, after being very, very servile, like I would say, like Muslim women are today, you know, that they came forth and they behaved very, very well. They took the men's job. Anyway, we had to move from there. The company got a lot larger, and they said that we would find a better place up near Udine, up in the mountains. So we travelled up north towards Udine, and in one of the hill areas, we found a lovely valley which had a narrow entrance which we could descend to a certain extent, and then it opened up into quite a large farming community just outside a place called Fides, near Cividale. And as you went up at the back the mountains at the back or the hills at the back, there was a lovely big meadowland on the top of the hills there, which made a lovely dropping zone, which was known as Canebola, Monte Giovanni's Canebola. And this place, like Canebola there, was quite a large village up in the mountain there, but there was no road to it. There was only a footpath to it. Everything had to be carried up. The women there, with the baskets on the back, you know, you could load them up, really, with all the stuff, and they could carry it. And I told you that, earlier on, that the Germans, and you said, what did they do with any of these Russians that they caught? I remember on one occasion there, although we were there, there's nothing we could do to have stopped it. They had one of these fellows, and they were going to send him down to the valley. Now, the people that collected the hay on the hill, to get it down to the cows in the valley, they had an aerial ropeway. And they kind of put the bales of hay on and send it down the ropeway. Well, on one of the occasions there, they got a little bit out of hand, and they got one of these Russians, they put him on the ropeway and sent him down head first. Well, it hurtled down the mountain, and the stop at the bottom was it was tied to a tree, you know, and he bashed right into the tree. A lot of things that went on there that we couldn't control.
Did you see him bash into the tree?
No, I was at the top. I just saw him going on it, you know. But you couldn't open your mouth about it, you know, because a lot of things were being done to them by these people. You know, as I said, you'd be in one village, and then you'd have this attack by the Germans and by the Mongols coming right up into the mountains there. You'd be on the run, running like hell, and probably a couple of weeks later you'd come back to the same village and the whole village was burnt down. This is what happened. So, actually, I suppose if I was suffering the same, if I was in the same situation, I would have taken retaliation against these people. I suppose this was a lot of it. Now, while we were there, they kind of got an armistice. The communists got an armistice with the Republicans, although they were at they were always upsetting one another, and they never seemed to work together. I think it was all a matter of when the war was over, who was going to be the leader, and I don't know whether they could foresee forming a government or what. That was one of the hardest jobs, trying to get a friendly atmosphere between the two groups. Can we just have a break now?
Had this captive done something particularly atrocious, or was he just...
I've no idea. I've no idea. Just one that they picked up, more or less. Yeah, and as I said, there were a lot of things that went on that we didn't like, and the gripe between the Republicans and the communists. But we had our lighter moments even in those days. I think one of the funniest. I think that the Edley Vincent Tucker, who was known as there. A bit of a psychologist, he knew how to play them. He was a bit of a crafty bloke, you know. And I think one of the laughable moments of he was, he says, in my bag there, he says, I've got a Union Jack. He says, get the bloody thing up. So I got it, and we were living in one of the houses in the village with the, I would say, about a mile and a half down the road would be the checkpoint manned by the army of occupation of the Germans, these Armenians or something like that. I was near as that, a mile and a half, something like that, down the road. He says, get this leg out and hang it out off the balcony. Oh, there's I hung it out. And as I say, I wrote this in the book there. And I said, it was the look on the Italian partisans' face as they went past, you know, looked up at the bloody flag, knew that the German... the German barrier were a mile and a half down the road, you know, as they walked past, they started, you know, they must be doolally-tap those English to have put that flag out there. But all the matter of showing the flag, like, we had different people come in, like Nick, I think, McPherson, was it? McPherson, something like that, insisted when he came in. We became the receivers of different groups that were coming into Italy. They came into us having the first dropping zone. They came into us and then they were dispatched on the way to different zones. And the people came in with the Mike Pearson with the kilt on, you know. Well, you can imagine the look on a nice eyes face when he sees this bloke in a woman's dress, you know. They couldn't understand it and that, and different things, and the mode of dress. We had one, we got a reinforcement, up to what I've been talking about. There were three of us, there was Vincent MacDonald and myself, MacDonald, I would say, and myself. And we got reinforcements in the shape of Taylor and Godwin. They came in. And they brought with them another fella who I think went under the name of Trent, Mickey Trent. And he told me he came from Liverpool, but I could tell the way he spoke that he didn't come from Liverpool. And actually, he was an Hungarian. Now, you understand that we're running, more or less, all this zone that we were, Friuli Venezia, was more or less the border between Italy and Yugoslavia. And the Yugoslav intermixed with the Italians and vice versa from time to time. Now, Mickey, he could speak Yugoslav fluently. He was Hungarian, actually. He spoke Hungarian, Italian. He spoke about four or five different languages. But he had one weakness, Mickey. He had an eye for the women. And I think he must have let it go that he understood what they were talking about with these Slovenes. This was... once when we sent him out on a job, and he didn't return from the job, and the Slovene said that they'd run into an ambush and he'd been killed, but we did get to know that they'd actually got rid of him, the shell, because up to then they used to talk, knowing damn well that we couldn't understand a word that we were saying. But Mickey used to tell us after what they were saying. And he let it go that he could understand them. He'd seen one of these women and started talking to her in her own language. And they got wise there and they saw him off. The Yugoslavs are a queer lot, and they've been a queer lot all along. Just like what Russia have been. Anyway, that was Mickey Trent. And we never did find out the where he was buried or anything like that. And now all the years that I've gone there, I've made inquiries, and it's a bit pointless at present because most of the people have kicked the bucket. And but early on, I was trying to get down to the bottom of what happened to
gimmicky trend. While we're up in the hills there, we got all sorts of people coming up to join us. We also had quite a lot of mostly South African. These had been taken prisoner during the desert campaign, and they were in camps in Italy. And when the armistice had come, they more or less opened the gates and they all flopped out, and quite a lot of the Italians took them in. They're living in the farms and all like that, and then the war was going to take a long while. The war came to a standstill in Italy, and they couldn't see any future in getting back home in the near future. So they decided more or less to make their way off to Yugoslavia. Then word got round that there was a British mission up in the hills, so they started coming through. Well, we got a trickle from time to time of South Africans and New Zealanders and all like that. And we kind of passed them on the way to into Slovenia, because down near where a lot of the tourists go now, Postumia, where everybody that goes to northern Yugoslavia for the holidays always go to have a look at the caves at Postumia, where they had a bit of a landing field there at that particular time, and people could be passed on from Yugoslav detachment to another Yugoslav detachment, and then she'd finish up there and be taken out either by DC-3 or something like that, and they got back. But as I said, those were the prisoners of war that came through. The Italians, they worked quite well with the theory. But as I said, there were a lot of this here stuff. I always think about Taylor and all, and Walker. Those are the two that came in last to us. Taylor and Godwin. And they were like dead keen on explosives, and they did things with explosives that you read about in the Rover of Wizard, you know, those books. And I can remember one time they got a damn big cheese and they scooped it out the middle of the cheese. I said, "What the hell are you doing there?" "Oh," he said, "I'm going to put plastic in here." He said, "I'll put a time pencil in." He said, "I'll get some Italian to take it down and take it into German mess down in Uden." You know, things like that. They were, they're what you read in the rubber. But those things actually went on.
Did they actually carry them out, though?
I don't know. I know that this was going on. And also, they got it in such a way, Godwin and Taylor, that the explosive detachment became like a special outfit, like the SAS of the Italian resistance. And what they did, they got British parachute wings, took the centre of the parachute out, and they got somebody to embroider a different badge in, and they call them Guestatores or something like that. And for a bloke to have these wings with an explosive expert and everything, he walked around with his chest stuck out, you know. But they went down into the valley. I remember one night they decided to do all the electric pylons that were going across the thing. And we sat on a little hill there, and they'd all put time pencils on. They were the most marvellous. We sat there for about 3 hours on this hill. And you'd see a flash of light over there, then a flash of light over there, then a flash of light over there. And it was all the pylons going down. And same with the railway. They did the railway in quite a lot, especially in Udine, which that was a big junction for the stuff going up into Austria up to Villach into Austria, and then to Germany, one of the main. So more we could keep that disruption on that line, the better. Udine at that time was Kesselring's headquarters. A lot of them were with these German paratroopers. I forgot what outfit it was, but occasionally we'll be doing something and everybody usually shout, back up, let's get out of here. And you grab your stuff and you'll be running up the hill with it, you know. And this is what they call a Restralamente, and the Germans were coming in. And you run like hell, you know. And believe you me, carrying a bag and trying to carry a V2 set and then somebody else carry it battery, it was quite a marathon. These were the things. Anyway, there we are. So this was our time in the... Now, people, I must say this, like what happened, supposing we're got in many, many scrap. They had the... they had a scrap there that lasted about 3 days, but fortunately it wasn't the high rate in German troops. It was some more or less army of occupation. They had a big scrap at a place called Athenes. It lasted about 3 days. And from that we had wounded people, you know. How do you deal with wounded people when you've no link in hospital and all like that? Well, people, you didn't even have the, you didn't have the real surgical stuff. You had blokes for you, there were hospital attendants, but, and occasionally you had a doctor in the thing, but they were all the general, more or less like general practitioners, not surgeons or anything like that. But the ones that were more seriously wounded, they could have got them across the Isonzo into Yugoslavia and up in the hills. There was at a place not a long way from a place called Tolmezzo in a blind valley, hard to get at. The Yugoslavs had one of the partisan hospitals run by a famous a heroine of Yugoslavia called Franja. Her name was her wartime name was Franja. She was a Yugoslav doctor, and she ran this hospital up in the mountains, which was, well, it was in the valley actually. The electricity for it was produced by a little generator run off the running water of the stream. A real primitive. I have some leaflets of it. Because now it's one of the places of historic importance, and it's been kept and preserved by the Yugoslav, and it used to go in the name of Bolnica, which is hospital in Yugoslav, Bolnica Franja. All kinds of operations were carried out there, amputations and one thing and another, but there was no actual, everybody that was taken up there had to go upon like a litter, should we say. There was no proper road up, you know. It was a hell of a job. There was like walkways made along the cliff face to get up to this place. And actually, the huts that were there, there were about, last time I went up to have a look at it as a visitor, there was about six huts, and these huts were kind of under the overhang of the cliff. And as I say, it's quite a place to go to these days. But they made one of the busiest pieces up there, really, the priest who used to get the last rites and all like that. They had, if one of the commanders got killed or something like that, they held quite a big funeral for them. The food, what did we eat? I told you, I can't actually remember. I know that food was scarce there, and I think we existed on a form of either pasta or polenta. Now, polenta was Indian cornmeal, and it was boiled in a big pan, and it was like a porridge, and it was just emptied out onto a wooden board, and you got a chunk of that and some milk. I can't remember much meat. Oh, yeah, I remember. One time, I don't know how they got this thing, they got a cow. And they killed the damn thing there in front of where we were staying. And everybody was that hungry. One of the Italians, I was, well, he was Bruno, that I've known all along. He says, here, get a piece of paper. And he got some old newspaper. And he says, get the meat, wrap it in the newspaper, and throw it in the fire, it'll cook. And that's what I did. A piece of meat off the cow. I thought it was fantastic, that. But they had... another thing. When I came from at Oswaldwistle, the local newspaper was Accrington Observer. And Accrington Observer ran a charity in which people gave money. They made little concerts. They organised all kinds of things to give money to this charity. And this charity provided cigarettes for the troops from Oswaldwistle or Accrington. And maybe every 6 months you got a parcel from the Accrington Observer with 50 cigarettes in. They're always the same one. They're always in a buff pack, a 50-pack, buff-coloured, State Express 555. And I remember that in one of the drops, along with my mail, that came bits of mail, which I'll come to in a moment, was this parcel from the Sunday Express, from the Accrington Observer. And the partisans, I handed these cigarettes out around them, because the partisans, the cigarettes that they got, if they were lucky, they got a tailor-made cigarette, which was an Italian one called Nazionale. And anybody smoking a Nazionale could smell them a mile off, you know, terrible stuff. Most of the time, they had loose tobacco in their pocket and a bit of newspaper or typing paper. They could get all of that, and they made it into a cigarette. And here's an interesting one. One said, you want a cigarette? I said, yeah, I could do one. So he said, here's a piece of paper. And he gave me the paper. And he had, you know, the pocket on the shirt, the breast pocket on the shirt. He had the tobacco in there. And he gave me the piece of paper. And he got the tobacco out. And he put it on the paper. Then he started looking in. And he started picking out from the tobacco and throwing things away. And then I looked. It was bloody lice he was throwing out, because his whole body was covered in lice. It was in the tobacco. And not only was he covered in lice, but we were covered in lice as well. I took my shirt off once, and I looked in my shirt. And all down the seams of the shirt, where the seam bent over, you looked underneath, it was all white eggs all the way down. So I felt terrible about this. I had, in all my private parts, I had lice. So I got down to the stream there, and I got really scrubbing away, you know,